From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, why hard times require soft power. Ever since 9/11, the United States has attempted to root out terrorist groups that pervert Islam. First, it focused on Al-Qaeda, later ISIS. At the same time, there was outreach to the Muslim world. George W. Bush made appeals for greater understanding between peoples the same week of the 9/11 attack.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace.
And in 2009 in Cairo, Barack Obama reached out to Muslims and called for, quote, a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. One based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition.
Both presidents championed a policy that came to be known as Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. Behind much of that effort was Farah Pandith, a political appointee under three presidents, Bush 41 and 44, and President Obama. She's also the author of How We Win, how cutting-edge entrepreneurs, political visionaries, enlightened business leaders, and social media mavens can defeat the extremist threat. Pandith herself is a Muslim American. She immigrated to the United States from Kashmir as a small child. When she came in to talk to our studio, she spoke about how violence perpetrated against her own family in Kashmir, where a border dispute between Pakistan and India has simmered for decades, has informed her career.
It's been an interesting reflection for me and why I became interested in these issues around extremism and how we think about the other. I was born in Srinagar, and we ended up, you know, settling outside of Boston. And every summer, we would go back to Kashmir, and I'd visit my grandfather, and I'd visit aunts and uncles and many cousins. And so it was very present to me. I knew where our family came from. And even though I didn't speak Kashmiri, and even though I didn't connect in that way, going back every summer allowed me to see the place that I had come from and hear the stories about my own family. I had a very specific experience that happened to me. In the spring of 1993, a member of our family, he was killed. He was a thoracic surgeon. He was the only thoracic surgeon in all of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. He was killed and his body was left on the doorstep of his family. And obviously, it's unbelievably tragic and horrifying. But on that very same day, because he was a well-known physician and he was very well-liked, a lot of people were mourning his death and came into the streets to take his body from his home to be buried. And during the process of taking the body to the cemetery, there were hundreds of people in the street, including his brother-in-law, who was my cousin. And there was a firing into the crowd. And so my cousin was killed.
Oh, wow.
So on the same day, we lost two members of our family. And it was a turning point for me for many reasons. One, even though I had understood that there was controversy between India and Pakistan, I had never really paid attention to what was really taking place. I was pretty young. But it was also really profound because I wasn't sure I understood what was really going on. And that was in the spring of 1993.
And for you at this point in your life, you'd finished college, you were heading off to grad school.
I had just finished 3 years at USAID, and I had been accepted to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I was on my way in the fall to begin at Fletcher, and I thought that I was going to be somebody who studied development because I had worked at AID and I was really interested in development work. And when I got to Fletcher in the fall, a professor said to me, "Oh, you're from that family. Why aren't you doing more to understand what's really taking place there?" And I was really interested in security studies, but I had never thought to unpack what had happened to our own family. We were still reeling from the deaths, and it was a very sobering, you know, feeling and emotionally sobering as well. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, Sarah, there's an opportunity for me to learn more. And I was lucky because I had two professors at the Fletcher School who said to me, "If you're interested in this, we can give you a grant. You can go into Kashmir and you can actually see for yourself and do the research that you need to do to write your master's thesis."
Wow.
And at the time, Sarah, no Americans were really being let in. And I kind of fibbed a bit in terms of me being able to go. I said I was visiting family, which I, of course, was. Mm-hmm. But I didn't tell anybody in my family, except for one uncle, that in fact I was going to be there that summer to do firsthand research and interviewing militants. Looking back on it, I call it my James Bond summer because it was really crazy. And I think I was a little bit irresponsible in the way in which I didn't quite understand what it means to do this kind of thing. But I was very lucky. I had an opportunity to talk to the central figures in the militancy, also in the Indian government. Mm-hmm. I met all of the players.
How did you do that?
Through family connections and friends. I was able to get one-on-one interviews, and they were kind enough to talk to me. I mean, it's weird. I mean, here you have an American of Kashmiri descent who's in Srinagar saying that they want to hear from, you know, you want to hear from them about why it is that they're doing what they're doing and what it is they believe. But I remember feeling like, I mean, it was safe. I mean, up to a point, Sarah. I mean, there were moments, there were a couple of specific examples when it was really kind of foolhardy for me to be doing what I was doing, mm-hmm. because I was in a car on my way to go interview people when, you know, things were exploding, and that was just sort of ridiculous.
Did you reveal to them that you'd lost family members recently?
They all knew. You know, Kashmir is a small place, mm-hmm. and people know from what family you come.
And did they know who bore responsibility?
At the time, there was a lot of push and pull on the actual diagnosis of who did what, and a lot of blame to go around. Even to this day, there's not a clear indication of exactly everybody has their own opinion. But the fact of the matter is, you know, when you lose two family members in this horrifying way and your whole family is affected, and at the same time, I'm now talking to militants mm-hmm. about young people. I mean, these people were in jail. They were in their late teens and early 20s. Why is it that you're doing what it is you're doing? You're beginning to get a sense of the emotion and the expressions of identity and belonging that these people feel. You're also seeing, when you're interviewing on the Indian side, how a government describes a particular situation and what their policies are. And I remember doing audio recordings. I went in with a tape recorder, and I remember as I was leaving Kashmir, at all these tapes, I mean, mm-hmm. firsthand, you know, interviews with militants in my bag. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I remember putting Bollywood covers on the tapes so that when I was leaving, that's what it looked like. I was carrying cassettes that were Bollywood music when actually they were interviews of militants.
And that became the basis of your master's thesis?
That was my master's thesis. And I stayed in the Boston area until 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, I felt it, as we all did, in a real way.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was in Boston. I was working for a consulting affiliate of a large law firm, mm-hmm. loving my job, and it was called ML Strategies. I remember looking out at Logan Airport from across that on that perfect sunny day, thinking, we knew that some of the pilots had left Logan Airport. And so I remember looking out at Logan Airport with this deep sense of dread, and also just praying that it wasn't anything to do with Muslims or Islam, because I knew what was going to unfold. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't know everything, but it was a sense of deep despair. And I recall walking into my boss's office after 9/11 and telling Steve that I had to find a way to serve. I had to come back to government because I was an American and I was a Muslim, and this crazy terrorist organization was trying to define my country and trying to define my religion. And I couldn't just sit here in Boston because I had done all this work on extremism for my master's thesis. And surely there was something I could do to give back. And I didn't care what I did, frankly, Sarah. And I just wanted to give back. But the roots of all of this, the sense of service and the sense of obligation to do more, stemmed directly from what I had seen happen to our family, mm-hmm. What I knew was possible with ideology, and what identity means, what this sense of deep identity and the struggle for identity, how it can transform people, how it can transform regions at a very basic level.
Did you know you'd be unpacking international Muslim identity and looking at this as your work?
I would never have predicted that. But I was asked to go to Kabul to do some work on sort of public diplomacy and engaging with Afghan youth. And I was only in Kabul for a few months, but it was transformative, obviously, when you're there in 2004 and it was in, you know, we had just the war and all of this kind of stuff that was going on. But you were also seeing this deep conversation among Afghan youth about who they want to be and what's actually happening to their country, and this incredible country filled with deep history and pride, as they should have, and trying to sort through what happens now. I was having conversations with young people that really, really struck me. I understood the power of community. I understood how important it was to open your opportunities to listen and not just think that you know things from far away, that in order to get solutions, you've got to be able to talk to the people. When I came back from my time in Kabul, I went back to USAID, and I had a colleague who reached out to me and said that the NSC was actually looking for somebody to be working on what they called Muslim outreach.
And we should explain what the NSC is.
Well, the National Security Council prepares the staff of the president, and it conducts itself based on a series of protocols that have been established over decades. But at its heart, it is, in fact, the heart of the interagency. It's how policy is made. So to be able to do Muslim engagement at that time was really important. This was 2004 that I began my work at the NSC, and we were just beginning to craft a larger strategy of engagement, both here domestically and also internationally, and how to open up channels to have a better discourse and how to listen to the ideas that were taking place. We wanted to build out the diversity of Islam and bring more voices to the table.
When did the phrase countering violent extremism come into play?
Sarah, we knew that we had to do more to stop recruitment. We wanted to make sure that we were not seeing people get recruited to groups like Al-Qaeda, but also the concept of the ideological us versus them is something we wanted to puncture across every possible system.
And so, I want to underscore that we're in the Bush administration at this time.
This is the Bush administration. And I'm working in an NSC that was extremely forward-leaning around engagement with Muslims. I mean, we were doing things that a lot of people don't really know about and really have forgotten. And I think that's wrong.
I imagine that also surprises people that the same president that goes to war in Iraq is the same person with this forward-leaning ideas that
sort of
you're describing.
This idea of dignity of everyone, I think one of the things that's important to remember, however you think about those wars and whether you like them or didn't like why we went in, America didn't go to war in a region of the world because of a religion. President Bush talked about that in 2006 in his national security strategy, of course, that said, this is a battle of arms, but it's also a battle of ideas. When the interagency began to talk about that ideological landscape of how terrorists, in this particular case, were using that ideology to recruit new people, we also, as a country, as the interagency, as policymakers, understood, rightly, that there were many kinds of ideology that were using the us versus them framework to bring recruits forward. And so the discipline was born to counter violent extremism, the ideological war of us versus them, and what could we do in a non-kinetic space to make sure that we could defeat those things? How do you build the antibodies? Unfortunately, in the last few years, CVE has become a political hot potato. People are defining it for their political ends.
One of the things that's important about the work you were doing at the time is that it's not taking place in a conference room in Washington. It's sending you out as an ambassador of sorts. And in 2006, you're actually in Copenhagen with Muslim teens, and their lives are very different from your adolescence at a mosque that's next door to a very Jewish community with a lot of integration. Tell me how it was different.
It was profoundly different for me because after the Danish cartoon crisis, of course, we as the United States and many other countries around the world were not ready and not prepared for that kind of international crisis. We had not yet seen how a viral video could make a difference around the world. Remember 2006, 2007, where we were with technology. When we understood that we had to do a better job of understanding the cultural components of what was happening around the communities that were being preyed upon by extremists, we had to get in there. We had to listen. We had to engage in new ways. And so I was moved from the National Security Council to the State Department, where I worked in the Europe Bureau for Ambassador Dan Fried, as the person who was waking up every day thinking about the ideological war and how we could build and get the kind of systems in place that would allow those antibodies to be built, which required me, obviously, to work with our embassies in various countries to talk to community groups, to talk to activists, and hear what they had to say about what was actually taking place for them. Because if we didn't understand what was happening inside of them, we couldn't understand how the bad guys were able to get and be one step ahead of us. So whether I was in Copenhagen or I was in Italy or I was in France, the same kinds of conversations were taking place, which were around identity. It was around my belonging. And for me, it was profoundly different than the kind of experience that I had growing up outside of Boston, because depending on the country in Europe, obviously some countries had been colonizers, and with that comes a lot of baggage. In other countries, the conversation, the political conversation about inclusion and diversity and multiculturalism was just sort of in a very difficult dance. You know, people were not able to sort of navigate through it.
It's even in the ways in which children of immigrants are described, though.
Oh, gosh. There's a word in Dutch that describes somebody who is not Dutch but is different. And I remember a young person saying to me when I was in the Netherlands, this is how they describe us. So even if we're third generation or fourth generation, we'll always be that. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine how that must feel? And it wasn't simply in the Netherlands, obviously. There were those kinds of signals that were happening across Europe. No matter where in Europe I went, I was seeing this crisis of identity of those young people who were who were growing up post 9/11, because they were seeing the word Islam or Muslim on the front pages of the papers online and offline. And there was this fierce attention to being Muslim. What could it possibly mean? And what's the difference between culture and religion? And how can I be a real Muslim? And as they're asking these questions in such an angst-filled way, the bad guys are right there with answers to say, you see, you're never going to belong, and the West hates you. So come to us, we'll show you how you can live your Islam out loud in a way that makes sense. And the way they were able to manipulate that narrative, they delivered those messages with peer deliverers. You know, they were not mm-hmm. coming from government. They were not coming from people who did not absorb well with that peer group, but rather they were doing it in sexy, savvy ways that made sense for that young person who was navigating through all of this. So I'm seeing all of this. I'm hearing about the identity crisis, and we're recognizing that the communities themselves have really great ideas on what they can do to make sure they amplify an identity that has nothing to do with an Al-Qaeda or a group like it.
So you're in government for the Bush administration, and you stick around for the Obama administration, even though you don't think you're going to. What happened? Why'd you do that?
As I said, I was a political appointee for George W. Bush. And having served, I thought that was the end. I was actually on my way out. And I wanted to be sure that the next administration understood how important European Muslims were. We had built all these programs in Europe from 2007 to 2009 that were the beginning pilots of things that we could be doing to build resilience within communities. And I didn't want to see all that hard work go away. And so it was very fortunate that my boss, Ambassador Fried, had said to all of us, you know, Secretary Clinton is going to be doing one-hour briefings. This is within her first week or two of being Secretary of State for the regional bureaus, and she wants to get an overview. And he told me, I'm going to bring my problem children. So you come and you talk about what's happening with Muslims in Europe. And it was powerful because in that first briefing with her, we're all crowded in her conference room, and we only had an hour. And 45 minutes go by, and she's talking about all other things. And then I think to myself, she's never going to get to me. But she stopped the meeting at 45 minutes, and she said, I know that I'm going to have a chance to go really deep on all of these issues, but I want to make sure that everybody that is sitting at this table has an opportunity to speak. And she turned to me and she said, why are you here? And so I said, you know, Madam Secretary, I want to tell you what we've been doing in Europe with Muslims. And the more I started talking to her, the more her eyes opened very widely. And she was asking really excellent questions, wanted to know what the European governments were doing and why Americans were in there doing what we were doing. And this was really forward-leaning. And she kind of joked to Dan that you guys are doing this in the Bush administration. And we and everybody laughed. It was all fun. And so Dan started speaking and he said, well, when Farah leaves, he was going to, you know, finish that sentence. And she cut him off and put her hand on his arm and pushed him back. And she leaned forward and pointed to me and she said, where are you going? And I had a job lined up. And she looked at me and she said, we will see about that. And the next day, I got a call from Pat Kennedy, who said to me, I'd like to see you. And so when I went to go see him in his office, he said, I've been asked to ask you what it would take for you to stay. And I said, Pat, when you are asked to serve your country, you salute. I said, but what you have to do is, I don't care how you use me, but I've had so much exposure to what's taking place. This is going to benefit this president, and I need to make sure that we utilize it. Just don't put me in some little box where I'm pushing paper and I'm writing things. Please take what I've learned over all these years and magnify it. And so Secretary Clinton said, do what you did in Europe, but do it around the world. I want you to listen to young Muslims and tell me what's taking place. And Sarah, one of the things that blew my mind about that was that it was extremely creative in the sense that nobody had ever done this before, and she created that position for me. But she also did something else, which makes or breaks, I think, the ability for government to actually find new paths forward. She said, you can fail. She said, I know everything you're going to try may not work, but test it, try it, experiment. And that's the very same thing that happened in the Bush administration for me, because they knew that all these things that we were building, everything may not stick, but we got to try things. Government tends to push things together. We're really risk averse. This was the opposite of that.
But you, how much do you think helped you being the embodiment of an American Muslim immigrant herself? How much did that help in your outreach?
One of the things that I have been told is, even though many people greatly distrusted our government, people were really intrigued that they were sending somebody at a senior level to go listen to what it is that they had to say, and they wanted to be heard. They wanted to be engaged. So the ability for me to do that, to be in that role at a level that I was in, allowed me to do that. I also had legitimacy. Because here you have somebody who is American. I'm obviously working for the American government, and I'm an American. I was raised in this country. But my origin story is so different. And in fact, I have a name that is confusing to a lot of people because it has elements of different cultures in my name. So they're intrigued. They want to know more. As a female, I was able to connect at a very powerful level in communities that were extremely conservative. If I had been a man in the job that I did, I would not have been given access to the women I was being given access to. So I had the best of both worlds.
But did you find yourself being challenged by young people who had read things on the internet that they felt they believed was truth?
Absolutely. Completely made up facts, historical facts that just sort of percolated up through the internet.
And how did you work with that?
Well, one of the things that was very challenging was this idea of you have to be able to educate them on things up to a point because you want them to see the diversity of opinion on a particular issue. You can't say this is the only way you have to look at it. You need to say you have to think for yourself, look at all of the expressions. And so I would have conversations about the diversity of Islam. I would talk a lot about what I've seen around the world, what others of their peers were doing in that same space. I remember having conversations in New Zealand with Somali immigrants. There was a young woman who asked me something about Israel and said, you know, I read this on the internet. This had to be true. And I said, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to think about a particular issue, but I want to ask you where you're going to get this information. And so I began to talk to her about the many ways in which she could use the internet to make the decisions for herself. And I pointed her to a variety of sources, both on the left and the right in the middle, on a particular issue that I told her that if you go to those sources every single day on that one issue, you will see a difference of opinion and you'll be able to discern for yourself. Some of this stuff makes sense, some of this stuff doesn't make sense, but you need to be thinking through that. The easiest answer in the world is to get that immediate high when you get the answer and think, I know it all, I got it, it's a quick answer.
Farah, so you did this work through two administrations. How do you see Trump's own speeches, mannerisms, having an impact?
I know for a fact, because I've been on the ground in nearly 100 countries, that anything an American president says, anything that congresspeople, I put it broadly, say, cultural leaders say, make a difference to how people perceive our nation. Obviously, the president of the United States has the most robust role, which is why every president up until this one has been very, very careful in the words that they use so that they cannot be weaponized by those who are our enemies. We do not want to give anything to the bad guys to be able to manipulate and say, look, see, what we are saying is true. Yet, in this particular moment in time, we aren't seeing that kind of careful attention to the way in which he's using language and the way in which he condemns hate, and at the pace that we really needed to have to happen. When bad things happen, like New Zealand, we need to come out strong and we need to come out bold, and it doesn't matter what kind of hate is hate. It doesn't matter who, which group it is, hate is hate. And we need to make sure that we are clearly stating that.
I mean, Farah, and before I let you go, I'm glad you mentioned New Zealand. 50 people were killed in a mosque, which a horror. And we're seeing a rise of extremism. We've seen Pittsburgh, Charleston. How do you see that fitting into the work you've done?
Unfortunately, I have watched, since 9/11, various manifestations of us versus them. We all have. And each time we see these horrifying events, we as a community of Americans or even the global community, you know, we get seized with this moment that we must do more. And then it trickles away and then the next thing happens. I'm wondering when it's enough. When we allow us versus them to take over, it will seep into every component of our society. And it doesn't matter if this is about Muslims or Jews or Hindus or Sikhs. It doesn't matter if it's about men versus women. It doesn't matter about, you know, race. It's not about that. It's about who we are as humans and what it is we want to stand for and what kind of societies we want to build. It is incumbent upon communities, upon the private sector, and incumbent upon government to stand up for what we believe in and stop being lazy.
Farah, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat. Her new book is titled How We Win. First Person is produced by Dan Efron, edited by Rob Sachs. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I'm your host.